everyone. This is Nicole, and you're listening to All Access Pass, a show brought to you by the Accessibility Collective at CITR 101.9 FM. We are broadcasting live from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded land of the Musqueam people. So on today's episode, we're going to be talking about accessibility in academia, specifically in arts and literature. And I am joined by Celine and Diana. Hello.
Hello, hello.
Hi. I'm Celine.
I'm Diana.
And how are you two tonight?
I'm feeling pretty good. How about you?
That is not true.
Okay, no, that's fair. That's fair.
I'm literally not 5 minutes great. Before.
I'm so sorry to say this on air.
It's okay. I was like not feeling well. I ran to the washroom and I was like, I don't know how, like, I was just randomly feeling nauseous.
Yeah.
I don't know why, just out of nowhere.
Our bodies are weird.
Right?
Yeah. But you're okay now.
I think I'm okay now. I just had some water. I had a mint. Yeah.
Okay.
I think I'm good. How about good. You?
Yeah, I was going to say, I think we're just all trying to survive the chaos that is November.
Survive the horrors.
Yeah.
This is a really strange time.
To be alive?
Yeah.
I have this saying, the earth feels funny tonight.
It does.
And it has applied to most nights this past little bit. But anyways, Celine and Diana, what are you studying?
So I'm doing a major in English literature and a minor in international relations. Yeah, that's what I'm studying.
Yeah, and I am also in English. I'm just majoring in English literature in the honors program for now. So
wow.
Minor TBD. It's a lot of credits.
Cool. Honestly, honors is enough of
right?
of a beast yeah, to take it's on a lot. To need a minor, but good for you.
Props.
And we want to talk a little bit about our plays having this conversation, being people with or without access needs. So I, Nicole, am a fourth year philosophy student. Yep, that's my life. And I do have access needs from time to time. I do struggle with some mental illness and require some accommodations, but it's something that is not chronic, and it is something that I am pretty lucky to not have to use consistently.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say I have access needs. Yeah. And anyways, Celine?
I don't have any access needs to what I know about myself. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's...
Yeah, no, that's fine.
But I feel like this is something really important that we need to talk about, which mm-hmm. is why I'm here today.
Yep.
Yeah. And I do have access needs. I think being a chronically ill student is, you know, the biggest... Mm-hmm. struggle, I suppose, for me being in the academy, or at least being a student so far. So, yeah, that's me.
Awesome. Well, not awesome. I'm very sorry. But I'm glad we can acknowledge that we can have this conversation and facilitate these discussions.
Yeah.
Regardless mm-hmm. if you do or don't have access needs, because making spaces better for students with accessibility mm-hmm. needs makes spaces better in general.
Absolutely.
So I kind of wanted to do this episode because I was thinking about how inaccessible a lot of academia is, specifically arts and literature.
Mm-hmm.
So like things like readings, even for a student that doesn't have access needs, it's pretty unrealistic for students to do the amounts of readings that they have to do when you're in arts and humanities. So yeah, let's like get a little bit into this idea that it's not really accessible to be in academia and the humanities space right now.
Mm-hmm.
There's obviously the fact that there's just so much reading expected of students.
Yeah.
And there's also the facts that a lot of the reading is in language that is not accessible. It's not easy to digest. It's very complex. And there aren't really any alternatives for students that don't really learn the best in literature senses.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I am a very good discussion-based learner.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I can do some readings, and then, like, I think my ideal learning space would be I do some reading, another student does some reading, and we come and present our points mm-hmm. together. I just think I digest information better that way.
Yeah. That's fair. Yeah.
Yeah. But Celine, you wanted to touch on a point about creating opportunities for accessible scholarship. Would you kind of like to take off with that?
Yeah, like the research I did before this was more related to academics who have like started their academic career rather mm-hmm. than students.
Okay.
I found a few examples. Do we want to talk about them now?
Yeah, let's do it.
So yeah, there was this book and each chapter was essentially talking about like a different what's it called? Different lived experience. Mm-hmm. One of them was colorblindness. And I don't know how, like, the information I found might apply to the humanities, which is what we wanted to talk about because we're English philosophy majors. But one thing I realized was that, like, academics often use social media. Like, for example, they use Twitter for professional purposes. This can be very intense in color visual experience due to like GIFs, photos, mm-hmm. data, graphs. So, wait, sorry. I didn't introduce the first lived experience that we were going to talk about, which is colorblindness.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. Where was I? Oh, yeah. Twitter. Yeah. Let me look through this.
Yeah. So, a lot of digital material, a lot of stimulus. Yeah.
Like, I realized this today because I'm taking, like, this literature class, mm-hmm. and one of the material that we're supposed to, like, watch or look through, or several of the material, is, like, visual. Like, mm-hmm. there will be plays and, like, films and, like, animations, and this might be very difficult for someone who's easily overwhelmed by these visual experiences for them to, like, look through or to interpret.
Yeah, and I think that with that, when there are certain aspects of curriculum, mm-hmm. such as like, oh, watch this movie, go on this website and do this quiz or whatever, if you have an access need and you can't do it, a lot of professors are like, okay, you're excused. But I really don't think that should be the solution. Mm-hmm. I think that kind of takes away from learning a part of that course, and I think that professors and curriculum have to get creative about finding alternative ways for students to experience all curriculum and all education. So that's just kind of my two cents on that.
Totally. Yeah, I think, Nicole, you and I were talking about UDL, Universal Design for Learning, mm-hmm. in another episode. And I think this is a great example of that, you know, there are so many ways to be creative with your assignments as an instructor. And Celine, I really liked that you brought up this book because for me, I experienced this kind of, I don't know, so I've been at UBC for, this is my second year here, now mm-hmm. I transferred. And when I got here, I felt such isolation, you know, being at a more research-oriented institution compared mm-hmm. to where I was last. Because when I would talk to profs about my access needs and my experience, I felt like they were kind of working on their feet to come up with a solution for me. Mm-hmm. So I had this perception like, oh my gosh, am I the only one who deals with this? Am I like the first person they've dealt with that's mm-hmm. like this? Because they don't seem to know how to respond to me, how to, you know, deal with me. And then I came across the podcast Diagnosis Grad School by Olivia Dreisinger. And in her very, very first episode, she talks about all of those things about, you know, being this absent student and having your profs not really know how to deal with you and all of that. And, you know, I just had this real realization like, okay, yeah, no, this is a shared experience. I'm clearly not the only person that's gone through this. People are talking to me, perhaps like I'm the first person they've come across that is dealing with this, but it just, yeah, really made me very aware of this structural barrier here. So anyway, going back to this book that you brought up, Celine, mm-hmm. it's just so nice to have this collection of people's lived experiences and have this all laid out, because yeah, I think a lot of us have this idea in our heads of what an ideal scholar or an ideal student is supposed to look like, and a lot of those are kind of ableist assumptions.
I will send this book to you later.
That would be amazing. Yeah, I was reading some chapter that I found online earlier today when I saw this, yeah. and I really loved what I saw.
Yeah, I also think that it's important to note that to think about academia. What is academia supposed to do? What is it supposed to help society with? Yeah. A lot of academia does funnel into research and trying to research what would contribute to the betterment of society and what our society needs. And it is really important that we have a diverse range of perspectives in the academia world, especially in research. And that includes people with access needs.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to get there, you need to have students with access needs getting degrees.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you need to have accessible spaces for that.
Mm-hmm.
Because you will not have a professor with access needs without having a student with access needs.
Exactly.
And that's a point that Celine wrote down that I think is like really important to highlight. That we cannot make academia this like exclusive endeavor mm-hmm. for able-bodied people. Like, it has to be something that everybody has the opportunity to engage in, because there's a lot of really valuable perspectives out there that we just don't get to hear about because of the lack of accessibility in academia.
I think also it's something we need to acknowledge is that the organizations or these institutions are the ones responsible for bringing down these barriers, and it shouldn't be up to like a person and their access needs to like figure out a way to navigate like academia, because yeah, like it's their responsibility.
Yeah, like what Diana said, yeah. Feeling isolated, feeling like you were asking too much, like that is not an experience that you should have,
mm-hmm.
especially yeah. at like such a big institution that you pay big bucks for.
Yeah,
like you are paying to get an education that you deserve just as much as everybody else here, and it's not a big ask to make that accessible for students.
Thank you. Yeah, absolutely.
did you feel like these professors like genuinely like this was the first time they've ever had a student be like, I need accommodations or I have access needs?
I think for me it's so hard to tell if yeah. they just, I mean, I bet I was not the first student. But you know,
did you feel like you were being an inconvenience?
Oh, definitely.
Oh, and that's terrible.
There's this horrible, like, yeah. feeling of, like, did I just not explain myself properly? You know, mm-hmm. I feel like the onus is still on me to
yeah.
make them understand. So I'm constantly thinking, like, oh, do they just not get it? You know, do they just not understand? Do I need to explain myself better? Do I need to come at it from a different angle instead of, like, you know,
yeah.
the assumption being like, or the gut reaction to be like, okay, how can I make this accessible? You know,
yeah.
how can I make this work?
Yeah.
And I think so many people, of course, mean well,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, and I could see there being a pressure that some people feel maybe from the institution to run their classes a certain way. But I think that we really need to change the way we think about all of
yeah.
that. What does a curriculum look like? You know, there,
yeah.
we've seen so many.
What alternatives might there be? Like,
mm-hmm.
even just the note at the bottom that if you need alternatives to the curriculum, those can be made.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah, so it kind of just sounds like you had to do a lot of heavy lifting in talking, in coordinating your access needs, when in reality it should probably be more of a collaboration.
Totally, yeah. And I mean, I've heard of so many worse stories than
mm-hmm.
mine, so it's so hard because I feel like I'm lucky
mm-hmm.
in that sense. Like, I came to UBC with medical documentation that I had since I was in high school, because
mm-hmm.
I was diagnosed in high school. A lot of people, if they don't get documentation, there's some talk about getting interim accommodations when you're awaiting documentation,
mm-hmm.
but I know
mm-hmm.
some people still can't access that.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there's already that barrier for a lot of people that if you're experiencing something, then how can you still access the
yeah.
meet those access needs without that kind of documentation? And so I feel lucky in that sense. But yeah, it's hard to hear what so many people go through. And I think it turns so many potentially really bright mm-hmm. disabled students off from academia entirely, which is really sad, I think.
Yeah.
I was sort of going to, like, you sort of answered this, but I was going to ask, like, do you think you found people who have, like, similar experiences? And, yeah.
Yeah. So, over the summer, I started to get involved with DUC, the Disability
mm-hmm.
United Collective, which was so helpful for me for this. The community I got there has just been, it really changed my experience, I think, even though I'm still quite new to the organization. It was just very nice to feel like, okay, yeah, hold on a second. How do so many of us feel like we're alone and like we are inconveniencing, you know, profs who have dealt with definitely multiple students with the same access needs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, why is there still this rejection of mm-hmm. those needs, you know? Like, I think that kind of solidarity is so helpful and mm-hmm. sharing experiences there is so helpful. But, of course, that doesn't solve the problem. Yeah. So there have been a lot of initiatives to try to curb that. But
yeah, we have a pre-recorded episode with Diana on it about yeah. Duck. Nice. And their new initiative coming out maybe in the next week or two. We'll see. But yeah, it's pretty crazy to hear about how much discussion there is around accessibility in the world versus how much action is actually being taken in academia.
Yeah, totally.
And there's just so many different aspects to it that it really can't be isolated to, like, oh, let's just focus on accessibility for those with, like, neurodivergence. Like, mm-hmm. it's really just got to be a very open perspective towards accessibility and, like, taking it as a case-by-case student. And maybe that's not achievable right now with the way the academic system is set up. But I do think it's really important that we start to shift that.
Yeah.
And we can talk a little bit more about other examples that Celine very graciously researched
yeah.
after the break. Not now.
Sorry. After the break.
It's okay.
At Dunkin' Donuts, each and every
radio show
is brewed fresh and served fresh at the peak of its flavor. If you're a tough customer, only the taste of this
radio show
will do. So go ahead, let Dunkin' Donuts make your
radio experience
exquisite.
Indeed.
Dunkin' Donuts, serving sweet treats from the Pop Underground. Thursdays, noon to 1.
Awesome. AWESOME. Adjective. Definition 1. Informal. Extremely good. CJSF 90.1 FM has been making awesome campus community radio programming on the FM dial for 20 years. Definition 2. Formal. Extremely impressive or daunting or inspiring great admiration. Listener support for CJSF 90.1 FM is awesome. Support Campus Community Radio today by donating to CJSF's fund drive at cjsf.ca/donate.
Hi, this is Nicole, and you're listening to All Access Pass, a show brought to you by CITR 101.9 FM. And if you missed the first part, we are talking about accessibility in academia, more specifically, humanities, arts, and literature. Mm-hmm. So we're going to actually jump back to a point with Diana about literature and accessibility.
Yeah, I mean, Nicole, I like the point that you raised near the beginning about academic reading, because I think it's a great example of so many different forms of accessibility, you know, questions of accessibility, where, you know, of course you have, if language is so difficult to parse, you know, of course that's going to potentially be a challenge for students with things like dyslexia or other learning disabilities. But even just for students who didn't go to a high school that really introduced that kind of text or anything, if you're being if you're just jumping in, you know,
there's really no transition, like mm-hmm. being a philosophy major, and I did not start off as a philosophy major. Mm-hmm. I started off as a psych major. Oh. And then a music major, and then an English lit major.
Oh.
Major, and then a philosophy major. It's been a wild ride.
I did not know the English lit
briefly
part.
One of us
very very briefly it was a blip in the system, but honestly, I'd say philosophy readings require me to fire cylinders in my brain that I did not know existed.
Oh, they're brutal.
And I'm in my fourth year of university, and I kind of just started it halfway throughout last year. And I have all this academic training. Like, I have a background in academia from everything else I've done. And there's just zero, nothing accessible about philosophical reading to someone who does not like have any access needs when it comes to doing readings. Like, the language itself is incredibly difficult to parse, and there is really no transition or help in learning how to read that kind of language.
Yeah, and it's so hard, right? Because I think, especially in a field like philosophy, you know, having a sense of the like arcs of mm-hmm. conversations and arguments throughout time is interesting, right? Like, you know, those, gotta love those 17th century bros
who yeah, are, those, you know, those Greek philosophers.
Yeah, all, you know, writing so densely.
And they do not have editors. They did not have editors back then. That was not a thing.
Just random spelling and capitalization. Yeah. But, you know, the best profs that I've had in English and philosophy are ones who don't assume that you can just parse it. You know, I think there's a sense mm-hmm. of, you know, there can be a sense of elitism in these kinds of cases.
Absolutely. Where, right, and that, like, contributes a lot to the disparity in accessibility in academia.
Totally,
the
yeah.
sense of elitism.
But the best profs that I've had have, you know, when I had a great, like, a brilliant Shakespeare professor last year, and I hated Shakespeare in high school.
Mm-hmm.
Did not know what he was saying.
Wasn't both.
You know? but I... 12th grade it came around. But anyway, last year, had a really great Shakespeare prof, and the reason why she was great is that she would walk you through things, not, you know, telling you word for word what everything meant, but would essentially model how to read, which I think is great pedagogy. I don't know why that's not the baseline for, you know, things like philosophy, where people are, you know, breaking things down and modeling how to read so that when you get to the higher levels, you can do it on your own.
Yeah, I think it took me a lot of time and patience to be able to do philosophy readings on my own. Mm-hmm. And honestly, like, still starting this year, I was a little freaked out by some of them. And I think, like, I got some advice from another classmate who is in their honors fifth year. Mm-hmm. And they were like, honestly, I'd say best you can do is partial comprehension. And I was like, okay, well, that does not make me feel better.
No.
Okay. And he was like, no, with this professor, like, trust me, partial comprehension is fine. Man. Just do your best. And I was like, I'm just going to get absolutely destroyed in this class. So I do... the best I can with this reading, and then I show up to class, and this professor does kind of what you were saying, Diana, like, gave us this breakdown of not everything, but, like, acknowledge, like, oh, super dense reading, very, maybe unrealistic to expect of undergraduate students, but, like, here's the gist of it, and here are some points that this author makes that I can elaborate on, and I don't feel like it took away from the further discussion that we had about it. I feel like it only enriched it.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of people think that you should come with a full comprehension of the reading so that you can create discourse and conversation about it. But I just don't, like, I guess, but I just think that for everyone, it's a little bit better to be on the same page about the reading before we go into the discourse.
Yeah.
So that just, like, really resonated with me, what you just said, Diana, because that happened to me maybe 4 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Do you have any experiences with this in lit?
I have this class that every time we have a class, twice a week.
Yeah.
We have so much reading. We have to read around like half a book and tons of poems. Like, so much reading to do. And sometimes I'm not able to comprehend how the prof expects us to read that, like, over the course of, like, a day, you know?
Mm-hmm.
There's so much reading.
Yeah.
And I think that at some point they stop expecting you to read all of it.
I've had professors be like, I know you've got a lot going on. Yeah. I don't expect you to read all 67 pages. And I'm like, great, we're on the same page there.
Exactly. On the same page, literally.
And
funny.
It's page one.
It is. There's a lot. They expect us to do a lot of reading. And
yeah.
Maybe you're right. Maybe they expect us to just get, like, the gist of it.
Yeah.
And then that room, like, that leaves room for us to be able to talk about it during class.
I think what a lot of professors might be scared of is not giving a full comprehensive educational experience.
Yeah.
And that's why they assign so much. And they are like, well, if you want the full comprehensive educational experience, this is how you do it. And I just think that's, like, A, such an old school ableist way of thinking about things. Mm. And B, like... just such a recipe for student burnout.
Yeah.
Like, I honestly think that I would like to give good faith to all students in academia to believe that they really care about what they're studying.
Yeah.
But I've had professors be like, okay, I'm assigning two readings. One of them is optional. The other one, the only real important part that I want you to like take notes on and be able to competently discuss in class is like page 444 to 447, and I really do look in depth at 444 to 447, and the rest of it I read to the best of my partial comprehension ability. But just to have that like relief to know that I'm not doing partial comprehension for everything, I'm doing the part that counts, and if I have time I can really enrich my experience by doing the rest, I think just makes my educational experience better.
I think that, like, I noticed this. I used to be in business school, for people who don't know. I was in business school for 2 years. And the readings we had to do were very different from what we have to do in the humanities. Like, if I was in, like, accounting, I would have to do, like, a chapter of accounting reading, which is very different from, like, English reading.
Mm-hmm.
But something I noticed is that once I switched in arts, it was much more common for profs to say, this is the optional reading, this is the required reading.
Yeah.
You don't have to do both. Just make sure you check out the required reading, and optional is just up to you.
And sometimes I have done the optional readings.
Yeah, sometimes I do the optional readings. But this was never the case when I was in business.
Like, interesting.
I never saw that until this year, and I was like, wow, they care about us. Or do they?
Marginally more.
A little bit more,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
I have such conflicted feelings about readings because the worst thing for me is heavy readings plus either response paper, like weekly response papers or discussions or things like that.
Yeah.
Last year, I took this history course. It was a full year history course. And the most reading I've ever had to do, ever. Yes. And I'm in English, you know, I'm in English.
Yeah. History is
so
dense.
Much reading. He did say, you know, the primary source is like the main thing you would do. Were you in
this? Is this history 102?
Yes.
I am doing that right now, and I have a weekly response paper due tonight.
Yeah.
Paper.
It's
like a response. It's like a one-page response.
One page.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was every week. And so I feel so conflicted because looking back, unfortunately, I do use a lot of the information that I learned during that class, and I kind of resent the fact that I do. I'm very glad that it was useful. It was a horrible time while I was in it.
Yeah.
The material was really interesting, and the class was super interesting, but just the experience of having to do that much reading and having to respond to it every week, you can't plan ahead, because for me, planning ahead is how I try to manage this. Right. Like, I start my reading in the summer so that I can stay ahead of it. That's and not good. Have to do this by week, because if I do it by week, like, I drown in it.
Yeah.
You know, stipulating that you have to do it week by week was just the worst, worst thing for me. But yeah, unfortunately it did work and it did get me to read a lot of stuff.
But like, I think that talks to the quality of student experience. Like,
yeah,
it really should not be the standard that we're all suffering.
No,
and like,
not at all.
You can't really go with the argument that some people are like, oh, maybe academia just isn't for you. Like, this is everyone.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, everybody is struggling. Nothing about this is manageable or accessible for someone who doesn't really have consistent access needs when it comes to school. I can't imagine what it's like for someone who does need to advocate for their access needs. So I think there's just like a general issue in how academia is currently structured.
Absolutely.
Oh, Nicole's like trying to.
Oh, I don't. Celine was looking aimlessly out the window, and I was like, "Is there someone else?"
I get distracted really easily. Yeah. I just saw someone walk past, and I was like, "Oh, who is that?" Oh. And then Nicole was like, "Who is that?" And we both went silent.
Anyway,
now we're here.
But yeah, like, we have a lot of our own thoughts on academia and our experiences. I'd like to touch on two other examples of accessibility issues in academia that Celine did some research on.
Yeah.
And I'd also like to acknowledge that this is a very small, streamlined view of what access needs may look like in academia, and that it's a lot bigger than just this. Sorry, Celine, you were
going to say. No, my bad. I just didn't know if you were done. But if you weren't here for part one, we were talking about this book and like the lived experiences that a lot of scholars and academics have had. We talked about colorblindness earlier, but another one that I found was like people who have difficulty with like hearing, so deafness and hearing loss, And one of the interesting things that was brought up by the person who wrote this part was that while there can be arrangements made, for example, with regards to like hearing loss, you can get a sign language interpreter, even though it's not easy. You can do that for like formal settings. Say it's a conference, it's like presentation, something mm-hmm. along those lines. But in academia, a lot of these like informal connections, mm-hmm. like with students, with other professors, with other researchers, these are made outside of those formal settings. So it limits how much
limits the student experience.
Essentially, the student experience. In this case, it was like a professor, I suppose. But in general, like we don't consider these things. The current like arrangements that are made don't consider these informal settings where connections are made. People network.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's how you get to work on a paper.
Right.
You network.
You network.
And I see here you have something else written that I honestly think about all the time.
Mm.
Simple questions can easily put the burden of, and this is a direct quote.
Yes.
Simple questions can easily put the burden of adjustment and accommodation onto the shoulders of someone with hearing loss. For example, you can hear me without a microphone, can't you? Like, these situations, like, I have a hard time really getting mad at professors because these kinds of situations usually happen when there's a tech malfunction, but it needs to be better. Like, it's not, I can't blame the professor for the tech malfunction happening, but I can be upset that by doing an entire lecture without a microphone and without all these accommodations, but just like ensuring that a student is able to like fully comprehend what's being taught, they're taking away from their learning experience. So I do think professors need to care more about students getting the full experience, whether it be visuals on a PowerPoint or being able to hear. And like, honestly, even if a professor's having a sick day, sometimes they're just too out of it to teach, and yeah, they deserve days off too.
For sure.
Yeah. But yeah, that one was hearing loss, and that was Nicole Brown's experience.
Mm-hmm.
And do you want to touch a little bit on stammering?
Yeah. So another one I found was about stammering. This was authored by Robert H. Mann and Brian C. Clift. And I think the experiences that are noted are by Robert. So what was this? Yeah, having a stammer can oftentimes result in trouble trouble navigating academia, as one's voice allows for them to communicate with peers in person or online. So this is a direct quote. What they said in the book was, one's voice in its myriad forms facilitates participation in the many activities of professional academic life, delivering conference presentations, teaching responsibilities and workshops, discussing research ideas with peers, carrying out clerical duties, contributing to meetings, and providing a succinct and coherent account of yourself when pursuing career opportunities, such as interviews, academic positions, and promotions. This is just like a list of a few times or opportunities that people who stammer may miss because of, yeah.
Yeah, and as I'm seeing here, there's like nothing that's going to cure a stammer or help a stammer. It's not the same as putting in captions. That's a very quick and easy fix, or having a transcript. I think a lot of it is, this part is the compassion of having, the compassion that we have for people with accessibility needs. And I see here there's a point of suggestions from the authors.
Mm-hmm.
On what to do in these situations where someone in academia does have a stammer. Disclosure, support. I think support's a big one.
Support.
Recognizing the differences and benefits of having a stammer. And I honestly just think it comes down to like respecting that just because someone has a disability that may affect their ability to coherently contribute in the ways able-bodied students might, does not mean they have any less important points to make. And space should be made for them to elaborate on those points.
For sure.
Totally. Yeah, I mean, I think I said this earlier, but it just really, you know, shows, especially in instances of, like, conferencing, when you are interacting with people face-to-face and your work is not just, you know, isolated in a book or on a screen. We really just need to expand our vision or our understanding of what scholars look like and how they mm-hmm. interact with the world and how yeah. they interact with their communities and all of that.
Yeah, I mean, when you think of a scholar, like, when you think of a professor, what do you think of? We all have middle-aged, an image that comes to mind.
Yeah.
Old white man. And I think that...
With a nice hat.
Yes. That perspective has only really recently shifted to include women. Mm-hmm. And it's still very white base. And it's only recently started to include people of color.
Mm-hmm.
And even more recently, like, this is, I in my opinion, happening while we are in university finishing our degrees, including professors that are maybe have disabilities or are just open about their disabilities. Mm-hmm. Like, there's a professor at UBC that is very open about his experience with bipolar disorder
mm-hmm.
and how it's, like, a neurodegenerative disease. Like, that is new. That is a new perspective that would not have been shared 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So I think in the present, now we are starting to experience, like, a myriad of professors that are starting to disclose that they might have access needs themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I actually had a really great professor who has very severe ADHD
mm-hmm.
and, like, really could not teach unless everybody else in the class was silent while he taught. And I think he knew that this was, like, not something you can ask of students for, like, an hour, but he would structure his class in a way that he would do 10 minutes of just lecturing and then 5 minutes of, like, students talking to each other and then 5 minutes of them asking him questions and he'd break up the class like that. And I think that was a really beautiful way of acknowledging the professor's access needs and teaching the class in a way that worked for him and the students.
Mm-hmm.
So that I feel like the access needs doesn't just extend, like Celine said, to the students. It's just academia as a whole.
Yeah.
Word. We're going to go to ad break, but when we're back, we're going to talk about accessibility centers and how they might play a part in accessibility in academia.
Do you love being caffeinated? And do you hate that greedy, soulless international conglomerates are succeeding in the cutthroat world of coffee? Sounds like local coffee roasters Trek Coffee is for you. Trek Coffee is 100% indigenous and military veteran owned and operated. Let's keep small businesses thriving. Stop by Sunshine Convenience on 4th, the Super Value on Commercial, or grocery checkout in the Nest to pick up some Trek Coffee today.
Discover Noreen Braun's album, Songs for Trees, dedicated to the forest and the spirits within the trees. As we fight climate change, trees are the lungs of the planet and we need to help them. Her jazz and blues are blended with rock and synthesized pop elements to create a textured and ambient soundtrack to nature. Songs for Trees is a narrative, with each song guiding us through a journey through the forest. A trip, literally and metaphorically, about the interconnectedness of all things. The Vancouver Sun names it one of 5 albums you need to hear. Find out more at noreenbraun.com.
Hi, this is Nicole, and you're listening to All Access Pass, a show brought to you by CITR 101.9 FM. And if you missed it, I am here with Celine and Diana, and we are talking about accessibility in academia.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Welcome back.
Hi. So we've talked about a lot of things. We've talked about academic readings and how that kind of spurred this whole conversation and how it's, like, really inaccessible. We've talked about issues in academia, accessibility issues in academia. We've had some personal testimonies from this lovely book. Celine, could you please remind us of the book?
The book is called, one second, I'm just scrolling up. The book is called Lived Experiences of Ableism in Academia, and it has many, many authors who either note their experiences or experiences of like scholars that they may know.
Yeah. So the three experiences that we, colorblindness, deafness and hearing loss, as well as stammering, are only, is a very small part of the bigger picture that accessibility needs is a much greater range. Which kind of brings me to my next point, which is we have an issue of accessibility in academia. And people say, well, that's what the accessibility centers are for. And what I'm going to tell you right now is that the accessibility center is sometimes great. They're doing their best. I really genuinely want to believe they're doing their best. But they are a Band-Aid for a much bigger systemic problem. The idea I'm getting at is that the way academia is set up right now systemically will never support people with access needs. And we need to start changing the way we teach, changing the way we research, changing the way we interact to make everything more accessible. And that would, like, hopefully get rid of the need for accessibility centers. Because having something to go to constantly for a temporary fix for specific access needs is not nearly as valuable as acknowledging the potentials of the wide, vast range of accessibility needs in academia and being able to adapt in academia as we go rather than keep the system we have now, fix it up when we need to.
Yeah, I think one thing is that knowing about accessibility needs shouldn't be limited to people who have accessibility needs. This is some, like, there needs to be more knowledge and more awareness of what people could, like, what other people could be experiencing, because I feel like I myself don't realize that some people may have issues with, for example, a question we brought up earlier was when someone asks, you can hear me without the microphone, can't you? Like, these are very small questions that I personally would be like, yeah, like, I have no issues with that, right? But someone else may. And it's important that we, increase awareness besides just accessibility centers and the people who may be going to accessibility centers.
Yeah, that definitely relates to the point I made. Like, it's not just about the people with accessibility needs. It's about how we approach accessibility as a whole every single time you walk into a classroom, every time you're given an assignment, when you're given a syllabus. Are you being offered, what's the word, alternatives in how you engage with educational literature? It's a lot bigger than just one person who has an access need.
Totally. I mean, especially when, you know, nobody's access needs are guaranteed to stay the same over time. You know, even with just temporary personal circumstances, you can't map out your semester and what your needs are going to be. You know,
I have the craziest story of a friend whose father passed away in January 2 years ago.
Oh my goodness.
And she came back to school and she had missed a midterm, and the professor did not give her a zero. He just said, okay, I'm going to place the 30% of the midterm onto the final.
Oh.
So it was 30% of the midterm plus 40% of the final. So that final was 70% of her grade.
I have heard many stories like this one where, for example, someone might get COVID.
Yeah.
Where they make it sick.
You don't get concession for being ill.
No.
Which is, to me, absolutely insane.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's insane that we don't approach these issues with compassion. Like, we're not asking for a lot. We're just asking for, like, some basic compassion for the human experience. Mm-hmm. Because before we are students and professors, we are people.
And, you know, like, the three chapters that I looked at for this, at the end, when they had the suggestions, all of them started with showing empathy. All three of them, the first suggestion was, I'm pretty sure all three of them did, most of the chapters at least, they started with showing empathy. And they were like, this is key, this is important, and this needs to be the norm.
Yeah. It's shocking how many times you could, or how often you request help. Or you request accommodation and you're met with so much pushback. Right. And I'm kind of like, why? Like, even if my need is an access need that you may not relate to, have you never been in a, like, been a human who has been in a tough place and has just needed compassion for your circumstance? What? So I think, this general idea that we need to approach all these issues with accessibility in academia with empathy first is really kind of how we solve the problem. No worries.
Do you want some water?
I think I'm good.
Okay. Sorry.
I can't speak, apparently.
You are so good.
You're doing great.
What I was going to say, oh my gosh. My voice is being all funky now.
Take your time.
The point I was going to make was that, as you both have kind of said, it's impossible to know what everybody's access needs are going to be. Mm-hmm. Right? And so empathy and being open to having these conversations in the first place is just so important. Mm-hmm. I feel like I sound like a gremlin now.
No. You sound great.
But, yeah, exactly that.
Yeah. We're not going to be able to map out every single access need, but we can map out a system where it's okay to talk about it.
Right.
And that is not a system that currently exists. And as I sit here in this station at 6:45 p.m. with Diana and Celine, we know we're not going to be able to change the structure of academia.
We're not going
to
fix it from our little station.
We're not, unfortunately. But I think these conversations are really important to have. It's really important to acknowledge and spread the message that there just isn't a whole lot of compassion and empathy in the world of academia, which creates so many barriers. So many ableist barriers for people with accessibility needs that have really important perspectives to share with the world.
Sorry.
No, it's all good.
If I can speak, if my throat will let me speak. I do want to say I do get a lot of hope from the public humanities shift or movement I've been seeing lately. I think it's portrayed a lot as, like, a response to a kind of anxiety a lot of humanities scholars have been facing regarding the relevance of the humanities more broadly. But I think there's such potential for accessibility, you know, accessible scholarship, and reimagining what accessible scholarship looks like in these kinds of spaces. So the podcast I mentioned at the beginning, Olivia Dreisinger's Diagnosis Grad School, that helped me so much, you know, just to hear this podcast made by a grad student who clearly put a lot of work and research and personal experience into this. But, you know, it was great to see something like that being funded by, I think it was funded by the Public Humanities Hub, partially. Mm-hmm. You know, just seeing these initiatives taking place where people are actually, you know, looking for ways to branch out and to include things like podcasts. Like, I've seen discussions about including things like podcasts in, you know, tenure review packages, right? Instead of just only counting academic, like, you know, the stereotypical 20 to 25 page academic article.
Right.
Or book chapter or monograph, you know? And things like that do give me a lot of hope. And that's the kind of structural change that I really want to see, and I really want more people to talk about, and I really want to see it funded. And I really want to see opportunities for undergrad students to get involved and to interact with that kind of scholarship and to know that it's out there and that there is a place for that, you know? That if you have, you know, research to share, it doesn't have to look one way, you know? I really want that understanding to be a more common one. Mm-hmm. And I have hope, you know, seeing this big push now, but I want to see more. That's my little rant.
That's a beautiful way to cap off our episode.
Yeah.
There is just so much room and space for academia to become accessible to everyone. And I hope someone in administration at UBC is listening right now. But yeah, we can just keep turning to student-led initiatives to really push for this change.
For sure.
And honestly, I think we should acknowledge the professors that make class accessible more, and reviews, those matter. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We should definitely say this specific aspect of your class made learning so much more accessible. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Like, it's all these little things we can do.
Yeah.
But yeah. This was a very comprehensive episode.
Nice, guys.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Celine and Diana, for coming on. Us. We, with All Access Pass, will hear from you next week. Or you will hear from us next week. My goodness. From 6 to 7 p.m. Good night.
Good night.